I didn't want to look at her anymore, or rather, have her looking at me, sizing me up. I put on an old hat and watched her in the mirror. Because Claire loved me. It was a straw hat with a net veil. I pulled the veil over my eyes.
You felt she was jealous?
Susan said in a motherly way, spewing smoke into the air, an octopus spraying ink. I adjusted the veil, then tilted the brim of the hat. She was extremely jealous. Claire was nice to me, and I loved her. She couldn't stand that. Not that she ever paid attention to me when she had the chance, but when someone else did, she couldn't take it. Susan leaned forward, elbows on knees, eyes lifted to the rough cottage cheese ceiling, and I could hear her brain clicking, a mechanical readjustment, tapping and turning what I'd just told her, searching for the advantage.
But what mother wouldn't be jealous, she said, of a daughter growing fond of a foster mother, honestly speaking?
I turned to her, looking at her through the veil, glad she couldn't see the fear in my eyes. Honestly speaking, she killed Claire. She shoved her over the cliff, okay? Maybe she can't be prosecuted for it, but don't try to sell me this new and improved spin. She killed Claire, and she killed Barry. Let's just get on with it. Susan sighed and put her pen down. She took another hit of her cigarette and ground it out in the ashtray.
You're a tough nut, aren't you?
You're the one who wants to let a murderer go free, I said. I took off the hat and threw it on the chair, scaring the white cat, who ran out of the room.
She was denied due process. It's in the record, Susan said, striking the edge of her hand into the other palm.
I could see her in court, her hands translating her for the hearing impaired.
The public defender didn't even raise a sweat in her defense,
the accusing finger red-tipped.
She was drugged. My God, she could barely speak. It's in the file, the dose, and everything. Nobody said a word. The prosecution's case was completely circumstantial.
Hands palm down, crossed and cut outward like a baseball ref's. Safe. She was building momentum, but I'd heard enough. Look, you want me to lie for her? Let's go on from there and see if we have anything to talk about. Susan slowly smiled in her red lipstick, pushing her black curls back from her face with one hand, her lashes very black against her white face, as if a bit ashamed of herself, but also somewhat relieved that she did not have to sell me as hard as she thought she might.
Let's go for a drive, she said.
Behind the tinted windows of her Jaguar, I nestled into the smell of leather and money. It wrapped around me like fur.
I want you to ask yourself, what's she guilty of? I mean, in your mind, really? Murder or being a lousy mother? Of not being there for you when you needed her?
I looked at the little woman, her black curls, maybe one shade too black, her eyes a little mascara smudged from the heat. The weariness was an act, but also the truth. Like so many things, the words hopelessly imprecise. I wished I had something to draw her with. She was in the process of becoming a caricature of herself. Not yet. Now she was merely recognizable, but in 5 years, 10, she would only look like herself at a distance. Up close, she would be drawn and frightened.
Honestly, aren't you just trying to punish her for being a crappy parent and not for the alleged murder?
She cracked her window with the electric button snapped in the car's lighter and reached into her bag for cigarettes.
What was Barry Coker to you anyway? Some boyfriend of your mother's? She had a number of boyfriends. You couldn't have been that attached.
He's dead, I said. You're accusing me of being cynical? She put a cigarette in her mouth and the lighter popped out. She lit it, filling the car with smoke. She exhaled up toward the slit in the window.
No, it's not Coker.
You're angry with her for abandoning you. Naturally. You've led 6 difficult years, and like a child, you point to the Almighty Mother. It's her fault. The idea that she too is a victim would never occur to you.
Out the window in the unair-conditioned part of reality, a very red-faced jogger trotted by us, dragging a tired setter on a leash. Is that what you'll say if I tell the truth at her trial? We watched her plodding down the sidewalk, the dog trying to sniff at the plants as they went by.
Something like that, she said,
the first honest thing I'd heard her say since I'd shaken her small hand. She sighed and flicked ash out the window. Some blew back in. She brushed it off her suit.
Astrid, she may not have been some TV mom, Barbara Billingsley with her apron and pearls, but she loves you more than you can imagine. Right now, she really needs your faith in her. You should hear her talking about you, how she worries about you, how much she wants to be with you again.
I thought again about my imaginary trip with her, the sight of her, the magic of her speech.
Now I was not so sure. Maybe it was true. I wanted to ask this woman what my mother said about me. I wanted to hear her tell me what my mother thought about me, but I didn't dare leave her that opening. Bobby Fischer had taught me better than that.
She'd say anything to get out.
Talk to her. I can set it up. Just listen to what she has to say, Astrid, Susan urged. 6 years is a long time. People do change.
My moment's uncertainty faded. I knew exactly how far Ingrid Magnusson had changed. I had her letters. I'd read them page by page, swimming across the red tide. I knew all about her tenderness and motherly concern. But now, there was something that had changed. What had changed was that for the first time in my life, my mother needed something from me. Something I had the power to give or withhold. And not the other way around. I opened up the airflow vent and let the air conditioning kiss my face. My mother needed me. It sank in what that meant, how incredible it was. If I went on the stand and said she did it, told about our trip to Tijuana, about the pounds of oleander and Jimson weed and belladonna she'd boil down in the kitchen, she'd never get out. And if I lied, said Barry was super paranoid, he'd developed a complex about her. He was crazy about how she'd been so drugged when I saw her at Sybil Bran, she hadn't even recognized me. She might win an appeal, get a new trial. She could be out walking around before I was 21. I had her own knife to her throat. I could ask for something. I could make demands. What's in it for me? That's what I'd learned to ask, unapologetically in my time with Rena. What's my cut? I could put a price tag on my soul. Now I just had to figure out what I could sell it for.
Okay, I said. Set it up.
The maternity ward of Wake Memorial Hospital reminded me of all the schools I'd ever gone to. Sand-textured walls painted the color of old teeth. Lockers in the hall, linoleum floors dark and light brown, acoustic tiles packed with string. Only the screaming up and down the halls was different. It scared me. I didn't belong here, I thought as I followed Yvonne down the corridor. I should be going to third period, learning something distant and cerebral, safely tucked between book covers. In life, anything could happen. I brought all the things we'd learned to use in baby class, the tennis balls, the rolled-up towels, the watch. But Yvonne didn't want to do it, puff and count, lie on the tennis balls. All she wanted was to suck on the white terry cloth and let me wipe her face with ice, sing to her in my tuneless voice. I sang songs from musicals I used to watch with Michael, Camelot, My Fair Lady, while all around us, through the curtains, women screamed in their narrow labor beds, cursing, groaning, and calling for their mothers in 10 languages,
It sounded like the laboratories of the Inquisition. Rena didn't stay long. She drove us there, dropped us off, signed the papers. Whenever I started liking her, something like this happened.
Mama,
Yvonne whimpered, tears rolling down her face. She squeezed my arm as another contraction came. We'd been here for 9 hours, through 2 shifts of nurses. My arm was bruised from hand to shoulder.
Don't leave me, she said.
I won't. I fed her some of the ice chips they let her have. They wouldn't let her drink anything in case she had to have anesthesia. They didn't want her puking into the mask. She puked anyway. I held the small plastic kidney-shaped pan up under her chin. The fluorescent light accused us. The nurse looked up at the monitor, stuck her fingers up Yvonne to check her dilation. She was still 8 centimeters. 10 was full dilation, and they told us over and over again there wasn't much they could do until then. Now is what they call transition, the worst time. Yvonne wore a white t-shirt and green knee socks, face yellow and slick with sweat, her hair dirty and tangled. I wiped the stringy vomit from her lips. Yvonne looked huge in the tiny bed. The fetal monitor was strapped to her belly, but I refused to look at the TV screen. I watched her face. She reminded me of a Francis Bacon painting, fading in and out of her resemblance to anything human, struggling to resist disappearing into an undifferentiated world of pain. I brushed her hair out of her face, made braids again. Women's bravery, I thought, as I worked on her hair from bottom to top, untangling the black mass. I would never be able to go through this. The pain came in waves, in sheets, starting in her belly and extending outward, a flower of pain blooming through her body, a jagged steel lotus. I couldn't stop thinking about the body, what a hard fact it was. That philosopher who said, "We think, therefore we are," should have spent an hour in the maternity ward of Wake Memorial Hospital. He'd have had to change his whole philosophy. Yvonne sobbed softly, rhythmically, hopelessly, too tired to even cry. I rubbed her stomach. Nobody ever talked about what a struggle this all was. I could see why women used to die in childbirth. They didn't catch some kind of microbe or even hemorrhage. They just gave up. They stopped caring whether or not the baby came. They knew if they didn't die, they'd be going through it again the next year. And the next. I could understand how a woman might just stop trying like a tired swimmer. Let her head go under. The water fill her lungs. I slowly massaged Yvonne's neck, her shoulders. I wouldn't let her go under. She sucked ice through threadbare white terry.
Mamacita, ay!
Yvonne wailed. I didn't know why she would call for her mother. She hated her mother. She hadn't seen her in 6 years, since the day she locked Yvonne and her brother and sisters in their apartment in Burbank to go out and party, and never came back. Yvonne said she let her boyfriends run a train on her when she was 11. I didn't even know what that meant. Gangbang, she said. And still she called out, Mama. It wasn't just Yvonne. All down the ward, they called for their mothers. Mommy, Ma, Mom, Mama. Even with husbands at their sides, they called out for Mama. 9 hours ago, when we came in, a woman with a voice like a lye bath alternately screamed at her husband and called for her mother. A grown woman sobbing like a child. Mommy. I was embarrassed for her. Now I knew better. I held on to Yvonne's hands and I imagined my mother 17 years ago giving birth to me. Did she call for her mother? I imagined her screaming at my father, calling him worthless, a liar, useless, until he went out for a beer, leaving her alone with the landlady on a cold November morning. She had me at home. She'd never liked doctors. I couldn't imagine her calling out for anyone. But then I realize they didn't mean their own mothers. Not those weak women, those victims, drug addicts, shopaholics, cookie bakers. They didn't mean the women who let them down, who failed to help them into womanhood, women who let their boyfriends run a train on them, bingers and purgers, women smiling into mirrors, women in girdles, women on bar stools. Not those women with their complaints and their magazines, controlling women, women who asked, "What's in it for me?" Not the women watching TV while they made dinner. Women who dyed their hair blonde behind closed doors trying to look 23. They didn't mean the mothers washing dishes wishing they'd never married. The ones in the ER saying they fell down the stairs. Not the ones in prison saying loneliness is the human condition, get used to it. They wanted the real mother, the blood mother, the great womb, mother of a fierce compassion, a woman large enough to hold all the pain, to carry it away. What we needed was someone who bled, someone deep and rich as a field, a wide-hipped mother, awesome, immense, women like huge, soft couches, mothers coursing with blood, mothers big enough, wide enough for us to hide in, to sink down to the bottom of. Mothers who would breathe for us when we could not breathe anymore. Who would fight for us. Who would kill for us. Die for us. The baby came 4 hours later. A girl born 5:32 p.m., a Gemini. We went home the next day. Rena picked us up at the hospital's front loop. She refused to come in. We stopped at the observation window in neonatal, but the baby was already gone. Rena wouldn't let Yvonne take the baby home even for a few weeks.
"Better just walk away," Rena had said. "You get attached, I lose a game."
She was right, I thought as I pushed Yvonne's wheelchair to the exit. Though her motives cared nothing for Yvonne, she just didn't want to become a foster grandma. She never had any kids, never wanted any. What's in it for me?
"Babies make me sick,"
she was always telling Yvonne.
"Eat, shit, cry. You think you keep? Think again."
Weeks went by, and there was no call from Susan to let me know when I would see my mother. Now that she'd won my complicity, I heard no more about it. Not in May, not in June. I sat by the river's edge, watching the white egrets and brown wading birds, fish in the current. It was my graduation day over at Marshall High School, but I saw no reason to attend. Even if she were out, my mother would never have come. Ceremonies not of her own invention didn't interest her. I would rather just let it pass quietly, like a middle-aged woman's birthday. The truth was, I was scared. So scared, I was afraid to even mention it, like the morning I did the acid. It was a fear that could open its mouth and swallow me whole like a hammerhead shark in 5 feet of water. I didn't know what happened now. I wasn't headed to Yale or art school. I was going nowhere. Maybe I'd learn to pick locks, hijack a truck. Why should my mother have a monopoly on crime? I sat by the water watching it flow, and the egrets preen, their button eyes, thinking about what Mr. Delgado had said in our last class. He said, the reason we studied history was to find out why things were the way they were, how we got here. He said, you could do anything you wanted to people who didn't know their history. That was the way a totalitarian system worked. Who was I, really? I was the sole occupant of my mother's totalitarian state, my own personal history rewritten to fit the story she was telling that day. There were so many missing pieces. I was starting to find some of them, working my way upriver, collecting a secret cache of broken memories in a shoebox. There was a swan in it, a white wooden swan with long black narrows, like the swan on Claire's frosted shower doors. I sat on the swan and made tinkle for Annie. There were white tile squares on the floor that I played making shapes out of as I sat there, flowers and houses. They were perfect six-sided hexagonals, and they all fit together. Also, a yellow kitchen linoleum with a paint spatter design, red and black, and laundry baskets. That laundry feeling the smell of dryer, yellow sunlight through a roll-down blind, my finger through the round pull. But who was Annie? A friend? A babysitter? And why had she potty trained me instead of my mother? I wanted to know what was behind the swan and the yellow linoleum. There were other children there, I remembered that, watching them going to school, and a box full of crayons. Did we live with her, or had she left me there? The next night, Yvonne packed a few clothes, her horse and her radio, but she left the picture of the TV actor in his frame on the dresser. Rena gave her some money rolled up in a rubber band. We all waited on the front porch with her until her latest boyfriend, Benito, came by in his primer gray Cutlass. Then she was gone. On the anvil of August, the city lay paralyzed, stunned into stupidity by the heat. The sidewalks shrank under the sun. It was a landscape of total surrender. The air was chlorinated, thick and hostile, like the atmosphere of a dead planet. But in the front yard, the big oleander bloomed like a wedding bouquet, a sky full of pinwheel stars. It made me think of my mother. There was still no call from Susan. Many times I'd wanted to call her and demand a meeting, but I knew better. This was a chess game. First the urgency, then the waiting. I would not run down the street after her begging. I would develop my pieces and secure my defenses. I woke up very early now to catch a few breaths of cool air before the heat set in. I stood on the porch and gazed at the giant oleander. It was old. It had a trunk like a tree. You just had to roast a marshmallow on one twig, and you were dead. She'd boiled pounds of it to make the brew of Barry's death. By 8, it was already too hot to be outside. I went back inside to make Tasha's lunch. She was the new girl in Yvonne's bed, 13, going to King Junior High, D-track, summer term. Grave, silent. She had a vertical scar on her upper lip, just healing. She flinched if people moved too fast near her. "You'll do great," I said, making her celery with peanut butter in the creases and a Granny Smith apple. "I'll be watching." I drove her to school in Nikki's truck, let her off in front of Thomas Starr King Junior High, watched her go in scared and small, her backpack hanging with keychains. I felt helpless to prevent her life from taking its likely direction. Could a person save another person? She turned to wave at me. I waved back. I didn't drive off until she was inside. Nikki moved out. She was joining a Toronto band. It was one of Werner's. "Come with me," she said as she loaded her pickup. I handed her a suitcase. We both smiled, checked each other for tears. She left me some addresses and phone numbers, but I knew I wouldn't be using them. I had to face this, that people left and you didn't see them again. It was in the furnace of oleander time that Susan finally called. "I had a trial," she explained, "but we're back on track. I've scheduled you a visit day after tomorrow." I was tempted to balk, tell her I wasn't available, make things difficult, but in the end, I agreed. I was as ready as I would ever be. So on a morning already surrendered to the scourging wind and punishing heat, Camille Barron, Susan's assistant, came for me, and we took the long drive out to Corona. In the visitor's yard, we sat at an orange picnic table under the shade structure, drinking cold cans of soda from the pop machine, wiping them across our foreheads, pressing them to our cheeks, waiting for my mother. Sweat dripped between my breasts, down my back. Camille looked wilted but stoic in her beige sheath, her fashionable short haircut limp and sweaty around the edges. She didn't bother to talk to me. She was only the errand girl. "Here she comes," Camille said. My mother waited for the CO to unlock the gate. She still looked wonderful. Thin and wiry, her pale hair twisted up in the back with a pencil stuck in it. 1.5 years. I stood up. She walked over to us, warily, squinting in the sun, wisps of her hair blowing in the wind like smoke. Her tanned skin was more lined since I'd seen her last. She was getting that leathery look like a white settler in Kenya. But she hadn't changed as much as I had. She stopped when she got under the overhang and I didn't move. I wanted her to see who I was now. My acid green shirt with the industrial zipper. My eyes ringed in heavy black shadow and liner. My ears with their octave of earrings. My woman's legs in a swap meet skirt. High wedgy shoes borrowed from Rena for the occasion. Not the pink girl with the prom shoes. Not the rich orphan. I was Rena's girl now. I could pass for any girl heading to just where my mother was. She would not take anything from me. Not anymore. For the first time when I visited, she didn't smile. I could see shock on her face and I was glad of it. Her lawyer's assistant looked between the two of us, uninterested, then got up and went inside the cooler concrete of the visitor shelter, leaving us alone. My mother reached out and took my hand. I let her.
"When I get out, I'll make it up to you," she said. "Even in 2 or 3 years, you'll still need a mother. Won't you?"
She was holding my hand. She was a foot away from me. I stared at her. It was as if some alien was speaking through her. What kind of a routine was this? "Who said you're getting out?" I said. My mother dropped my hand, stepped back a pace. The look in her eyes faded, the aquamarine to robin's egg. "I just said I'd talk to you. I didn't say I'd do it. I've got a deal to make." Now, robin's egg turned to ash.
"What deal?"
she asked, leaning against a post, her arms folded across the front of her denim dress, the very same dress she wore when I saw her last, now 2 shades lighter blue. "A trade," I said. "Here's the deal. There are certain things I want to know. You tell me, and I'll do what you want me to do." My mother picked one of the dandelions out of the grass, blew the tufts from the head.
"Or what?"
"Or I tell the truth, and you can rot in here till you die," I said. I heard the grass rustle as she changed her position. When I looked, she was lying on her back, examining the stem from which the plumes had been blown.
"Susan can discredit your testimony any number of ways."
"You need me," I said. "You know it." She kicked off her 2-hole tennis shoes and ran her feet through the grass.
"You used to have a certain delicacy about you, a transparency. You've become heavy, opaque."
"Who was my father?" I asked.
"A man,"
watching her bare toes clicking together. "Klaus Anders, no middle name," I said, picking at a scab on the web of my hand. "Painter, age 40, born Copenhagen, Denmark, How did you meet?
In Venice Beach.
She was still watching her feet.
At one of those parties that last all summer long. He had the drugs.
You look just like brother and sister, I said.
He was much older than I, she said.
She rolled over onto her belly.
He was 40, a painter of biomorphic abstractions. It was already passé by that time.
She parted the grass like short hair.
He was always passé, his ideas, his enthusiasms.
Mediocre.
I don't know what I saw in him.
Don't say you don't know. That's crap, I said. She sighed. I was making her tired. So what?
It was a long time ago, Astrid. Several lifetimes, at least. I'm not the same person.
Liar, I said. You're exactly the same. She was silent. I'd never called her a name before.
You're still such a child, aren't you? She said.
I could tell she was struggling for composure.
You've taken my propaganda for truth.
So set me straight, I said. What was it you saw in him?
Comfort, probably. He was easy, very physical. He made friends easily. He called everybody pal.
She smiled slightly, still looking down at the grass. She was parting like going through a file.
Big and easy. He asked nothing of me.
Yes, I believe that. A man who wanted something from her would never have been attractive. It had to be her desire. Her fire.
Then what?
She plucked a handful of grass, threw it away.
Do we have to do this? It's such an old newsreel.
I want to see it, I said.
He painted. He got loaded more than he painted. He went to the beach. He was mediocre. There's just not much to say. It's not that he was going nowhere. It's that he'd already arrived.
And then you got pregnant. She cut me a killing look.
I didn't get pregnant.
I'll leave that for your illiterate friends. I decided I would have you. Decision being the operative word. She let her hair down, shook the grass out of it. It was raw silk in the filtered light.
Whatever fantasy you might have spun for yourself, an accident you were not. A mistake, maybe, but not an accident.
Why him? Why then?
I needed someone, didn't I? He was handsome, good-natured. He wasn't averse to the idea. Voila.
Did you love him?
I don't want to talk about love, that semantic rat's nest.
She unbent her long, slim legs and stood brushing her skirt off. She leaned against the tree trunk, one foot up on the white flesh, crossed her arms to steady herself.
We had a rather heated sexual relationship. One overlooks many things.
You worshipped him. I read it in your journal.
Worship is not quite the word we're looking for here, she said, watching the road. Worship assumes a spiritual dimension. I'm looking for a term with an earthier connotation.
Then I was born.
Then you were born.
I imagined him and her, the blondes, him with that wide laughing mouth, probably stoned out of his mind, her comfortable in the curve of his heavy arm. Did he love me? She laughed, the commas of irony framing her mouth.
He was rather a child himself, I'm afraid. He loved you the way a boy loves a pet turtle or a road race set. He could take you to the beach and play with you for hours, lifting you up and down in the surf, or he could stick you in the playpen and leave the house to go out drinking with his friends when he was supposed to be babysitting. One day I came home and there had been a fire. His turpentine-soaked rags and brushes had caught fire. The house went up in about 5 minutes.
He was nowhere around. Evidently, your crib sheet had already scorched. It was a miracle you weren't burned alive. A neighbor heard you screaming. I tried to remember the playpen, the fire. I could distinctly remember the smell of turpentine, a smell I'd always loved. But the smell of fire, that pervasive odor of danger, I'd always associated with my mother. That was the end of our idyll, Divinus Beach. I was tired of his mediocrity, his excuses. I was making what little money we had. He was living off me. We had no home anymore. I told him it was over. He was ready, believe me. There were no tears on that score. And so ends the saga of Ingrid and Klaus. But all I could think of was the big man lifting me in and out of the surf. I could almost remember it, the feeling of the waves on my feet bubbling like laughter, the smell of the sea and the roar. Did he ever try to see me as I grew up? No. Does that make you feel any better? She walked to the fence to look out at the road, the dirt and trash blowing in the wind, trash stuck in the weeds on the other side of the road. Maybe once or twice. He came by to see if you were all right, but I let him know in no uncertain terms that his presence was no longer appreciated. And that was that. I thought of him, his sheepish face, the long blonde hair. He hadn't meant to hurt me. She could have given him another chance. You never thought maybe I'd like a father? In ancient times, there were no fathers. Women copulated with men in the fields, and their babies came 9 months later. Fatherhood is a sentimental myth, like Valentine's Day. She turned back to me, her aquamarine eyes pale behind her tanned face, like a crime in a lit room behind curtains. Have I answered enough, or is there more? He never came back? I asked quietly, praying it wasn't true, that there was more, just a scrap more. Never called you later on, wanting to see me? She squatted down again, put her arm around me, propped her head against mine. He called once, when you were, I don't know, 7 or 8. She ran her fingers through my hair. He was visiting from Denmark with his wife and his 2 small children. He wanted us to meet at a park, that I should sit on the park bench and play with you so he could see you. Did we go? I just wanted her to hold me. It sounded like the plot of a bad movie, she said. I told him to go to hell. He had called. He had wanted to see me. And she said no. Without asking me, without mentioning it, it struck me across the throat like a blow with a pipe. I got up and went to lean on the tree trunk on the other side of the trunk. She could hardly see me from there, but I could hear her. You wanted to know. Don't turn over rocks if you don't want to see the pale creatures who live under them. My shirt didn't absorb sweat. It pooled and was soaked into the waistband of my skirt. I felt I'd been waiting. Tell me about Annie. Why do you have to hold on to the past? She sat up, twisted her hair back, skewered it with the pencil. Her voice was sharp, irritated. What's the past? Just a pile of moldy newspapers in some old man's garage. The past is still happening. It never stopped. Who was Annie? The wind shook the dense, glossy foliage of the ficus. There was no other sound. She ran her fingers over her hair, pulling tight like she was climbing out of a pool. She was a neighbor. She took in kids, did people's laundry. The smell of laundry. The laundry basket, sitting in the laundry basket with other children, playing. We were in a boat, the little squares. It was yellow, We scooted it across the kitchen floor.
What did she look like?
Small. Talkative. She shaded her eyes with one hand. She wore those Dr. Scholl's sandals.
And where were you?
My mother was silent. She pressed her hand down on her eyes. How could you possibly have remembered this?
Everything she knew about me, everything she walked around with in that thin skull case like a vault. I wanted to crack her open, eat her brain like a soft-boiled egg.
Imagine my life for a moment, she said, quietly, cupping her long fingers like a boat, like she was holding her life in a shell. Imagine how unprepared I was to be the mother of a small child. The demand for the enactment of the archetype, the selfless, eternal feminine. It couldn't have been more foreign. I was a woman accustomed to following a line of inquiry or inclination until it led to its logical conclusion. I was used to having time to think, freedom. I felt like a hostage. Can you understand how desperate I was?
I didn't want to understand, but I remembered. On the other side of the fence, past my mother's head, the young women in reception watched one of them sweeping the concrete courtyard, sweeping, sweeping, like it was a penance. That's what babies are like. What were you thinking? That I would amuse you? That you and I could exchange thoughts on Joseph Brodsky?
She sat up, crossed her legs, and rested her hands on her knees. I thought Klaus and I were going to live happily ever after. Adam and Eve in a vine-covered shack. I was walking the archetypes. I was out of my fucking mind.
You were in love with him.
Yes, I was in love with him, all right? She yelled at me. I was in love with him, and baby makes three, and all that jazz. And then we had you, and I woke up one morning married to a weak, selfish man, and I couldn't stand him. And you just wanted, mommy, 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 until I thought I would throw you against the wall.
I felt sick. I had no trouble believing it, seeing it. I saw it all too clearly, and I understood why she never told me about this, had simply, kindly, refrained.
So, you left me there?
I hadn't really intended to. I dropped you at her house just for the afternoon to go to the beach with some friends. And one thing led to another. They had some friends down in Ensenada. And I went. And it felt wonderful, Astrid, to be free. You can't imagine. To go to the bathroom by myself. To take a nap in the afternoon, to make love all day long if I wanted, and walk on the beach and not have to think, where's Astrid? What's Astrid doing? What's she going to get into? And not having you on me all the time, mommy, 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 clinging to me like a spider.
She shuddered. She still remembered my touch with revulsion. It made me dizzy with hatred. This was my mother, the woman who raised me. What chance could I ever have had?
How long were you gone?
My voice sounded flat and dead in my own ears.
A year, she said quietly. Give or take a few months.
And I believed it. Everything in my body told me that was right. All those nights waiting for her to come home, listening for her key in the lock. No wonder. No wonder they had to tear me away from her when I started school. No wonder I always worried she was going to leave me one night. She already had.
But you're asking the wrong question, she said. Don't ask me why I left. Ask me why I came back.
You should have been sterilized. Suddenly she was up, pinning me by my shoulders to the tree trunk. Her eyes were a sea in fog.
I could have left you there, but I didn't. Don't you understand? For once, I did the right thing for you.
I was supposed to forgive her now, but it was too late.
Bully for you,
I replied dryly. She dropped her grip on my arms.
You were never like this before, she said. You're so hard. Susan told me, but I thought it was just a pose. You've lost yourself. Your dreaminess, that tender quality.
I would have thought you'd approve. Wasn't that the thing you hated about Claire? Her tenderness. Be strong, you said. I despise weakness.
I wanted you to be strong.
But intact, she said.
Not this devastation. You're like a bomb sight. You frighten me.
She reached out her hand as if to touch my face like a blind woman, but she couldn't reach me. I would burn her if she touched me. The hand stayed in the air, hovering in front of my face. I saw. She was afraid.
You were the one thing that was entirely good in my life, Astrid. Since I came back for you, we've never been apart. Not until this.
The murder, you mean?
No. This. You. Now.
The gesture, the attempt to reach me, faded like sunset.
You know, when I came back, you knew me. You were sitting there by the door when I came in. You looked up and you smiled and reached for me to pick you up, as if you were waiting for me.
I wanted to cut through this moment with the blue flame of an acetylene torch. I wanted to burn it to ash and scatter it into the wind so the pieces would never come back together again. I was always waiting for you, Mother. It's the constant in my life. Waiting for you. Will you come back? Will you forget that you've tied me up in front of a store? Left me on the bus? The hand came out again. Tentatively, but this time it lightly touched my hair.
Are you still?
No, I said, brushing her hand away. I stopped when Claire showed me what it felt like to be loved. Now she looked tired. Every day of 49 years. She picked up her shoes.
Is there anything else you want? Have I fulfilled my end of the bargain?
What are you going to do when you get out? I asked her. Where are you going to go? She sighed.
By the time Susan is done, I'll be a household icon like Aunt Jemima, the Pillsbury Doughboy. I'll have my choice of teaching positions.
Where would you like to go, Astrid? She glanced at me, smiled. My carrot, reminding me which end of the plank, and so on. That's years away, I said.
You can't make it alone, she said.
You need an environment, a context, people invested in your success. God knows, look at me. I had to go to prison to get noticed. The cars started up, crunched over the gravel. Camille came out of the shelter, pointed at her watch. It was over. I felt empty and used. Whatever I thought knowing the truth would do for me, it hadn't. It was my last hope. I wanted her to hurt the way I did. I wanted it very much. So, how does it feel knowing I don't give a damn anymore? I said. That I'll do anything to get what I want. Even lie for you. I won't blink an eye. I'm like you now, aren't I? I look at the world and ask, what's in it for me? She shook her head, gazed down at her bare, tanned feet. If I could take it all back, I would, Astrid. She lifted her eyes to mine. You've got to believe me. Her eyes, glinting in the sun, were exactly the color of the pool we swam in together the summer she was arrested. I wanted to swim there again, to submerge myself in them. Then tell me you don't want me to testify, I said. Tell me you don't want me like this. Tell me you would sacrifice the rest of your life to have me back the way I was. She turned her blue gaze toward the road. That road. The beautiful road. The road women in prison dreamed about. The road she had already left me for once. And suddenly I felt panic. I'd made a mistake, like when I'd played chess with Ray and knew a second too late I'd made the wrong move. I had asked a question I couldn't afford to know the answer to. It was the thing I didn't want to know, the rock that never should be turned over. I knew what was under there. I didn't need to see it, the hideous, eyeless albino creature that lived underneath. Listen, forget it. A deal's a deal. Let's leave it at that. The wind crackled its dangerous whip in the air. I imagined I could see the shower of sparks, smell the ashes. I was afraid she hadn't heard me. She was still as a daguerreotype, arms crossed across her denim dress. I'll tell Susan, she said quietly, to leave you alone. I knew I had heard her, but I didn't believe it. I waited for something to make me believe it was true. My mother came back to me then, put her arms around me, rested her cheek against my hair. Although I knew it was impossible, I could smell her violets. If you could go back even partway, I would give anything, she said into my ear. Her large hands gently stroked my hair. It was all I ever really wanted, that revelation. The year my mother's new trial was held, February, was bitter cold. I was living in Berlin with Paul Trout, in a fourth-story flat in the old Eastern Sector, a sublet of a sublet some friends found for us. It was crumbling and coal-heated, but we could afford it most of the time. Ever since Paul's graphic novels had become the codebook of a new secret society among European art students, we'd made friends in every city. They passed us along from squat to sublet to spare couch, like torches in a relay race. I liked Berlin. The city and I understood each other. I liked that they had left the bombed-out hulk of the Kaiser Wilhelm Church as a monument to loss. Nobody had forgotten anything here. In Berlin, you had to wrestle with the past. You had to build on the ruins. Inside them. It wasn't like America, where we scraped the earth clean, thinking we could start again every time. We hadn't learned yet. There was no such thing as an empty canvas. I had begun turning to sculpture, an outgrowth of my time with Rina Grushenka. I developed an obsessive fondness for scavenged materials, for flea markets and curbside treasures, and haggling in six different languages. Over time, this flotsam worked its way into my art, along with bits of German in Worship of the Real and 24 kinds of animal scat. That year, I craved suitcases. I haunted the flea market near the Tiergarten, bargaining and trading for old-fashioned suitcases. There were thousands for sale now since unification. Leather with yellow celluloid handles, train cases, and hat boxes. In the old eastern sector, no one had ever thrown them out because there had been nothing to replace them with. Now, they sold cheap. The easterners were buying the latest carry-ons, uprights with wheels. Along the flea market booths, the dealers all knew me. Handkoffer Fräulein, they called me. Suitcase girl. I was making altars inside them. Secret, portable museums. All winter long, I sat on the floor in the corner of the flat with my glue and my clay, resins and solvents and paint and thread and bags of scavenged materials, my coat still on, my fingerless gloves. I could never decide whether to work with the windows open to ventilate fumes or closed to stay warm. It depended. Sometimes my sense of futurity was stronger. Sometimes my sense there was only the past. I was creating my personal museum. They were all here. Claire, my mother and star. Yvonne and Nikki and Rena. The Musée d'Astrid Magnusson. I'd had to leave everything behind at Rena's when I went to New York to find Paul, all my boxes and souvenirs, everything but my mother's 4 books plus $800 in cash. My mother and I wrote a couple of times a month using the comic book shop near the university as a letter drop. Sometimes she had her lawyer send me a little money from her poems or, more likely, scammed off a fan. I told her I didn't want to know about her preparations for trial, but her letters boasted of offers lined up. Amherst, Stanford, Smith, dangling the carrot of green college campuses. I imagined myself a professor's daughter, riding a bike to my classes. I could wear a camel's hair coat at last, have a roommate, play intramural volleyball, all paid for in advance. How safe it would be, contained, everything decided for me. I could be a child again. I could start over. Sure I wouldn't want to come home? I reached out and touched a tine of barbed wire, rang the chimes. The beauty and the madness, wasn't it? What was being weighed on the scales of the night? Later, I lay under the feather bed, fully clothed, not for sleep, but just to stay warm. The space heater buzzed and threw out the familiar smell of burned hair. The window panes were frosted over, and I could see my breath in the room. Paul came home about 9, took off his boots and climbed under the covers. He had a greasy paper bag of kebabs from the local Turkish fast food. My stomach growled. Paul threw a newspaper on top of me. "Guess who?" he said. It was tomorrow's International Herald Tribune, still smelling of wet ink. I opened it, and there she was on page 3. Jailed poet found innocent after 9 years. Smiling her half-smile, waving like royalty returning from exile, happy but still mistrusting the masses. She had made it through trial without me. She was free. Paul ate his kebab sandwich, dropping pieces of salad back onto the bag as I quickly read the story, more shocked than I thought I would be. They'd taken the defense that Barry had committed suicide and made it look like murder. I was appalled that it worked. My mother was quoted saying how grateful she was that justice had been done. She looked forward to taking a bath. She thanked the jurors from the bottom of her heart. She said she'd received offers to teach, to publish her autobiography, to marry an ice cream millionaire and pose for Playboy, and she was going to accept them all. Paul offered me a falafel. I shook my head. Suddenly I wasn't hungry anymore. "Save it for later," he said, and dropped the bag by the side of the bed. His rich brown eyes asked every question. He didn't have to say a word. I rested my head in the crook of his shoulder and gazed at the squares of blue TV light shining through the frost blossoms on our window from the windows just across the way. I tried to imagine what she was feeling right now. In Los Angeles, it was noon, a bright, sunny February it looked from the picture. I imagined her in a hotel room, courtesy Susan D. Valera's, some luxury suite full of flowers from well-wishers, waking up on fresh sheets. She would have her bath in a double-wide tub and write a poem overlooking the winter roses. Then, she might take a few interviews or rent a white convertible for a spin down the beach where she'd pick up a young man with clear eyes and sand in his hair and make love to him until he wept with the beauty of it. What else would you do when you were acquitted of murder? It was too much to imagine her tempering her joy with a moment of grief, a moment for the knowledge of what her triumph had caused. I couldn't expect that from her. But I had seen her remorse, and it had nothing to do with Barry or anyone else. It was a gift offered despite a price she had had no way to estimate then. It could have been heavy as mourning, final as a tomb. No matter how much she had damaged me or how flawed she was, how violently mistaken, my mother loved me. Unquestionably. I reached out and pressed my palm to the frosted panes, leaving a perfect outline against the darkness. In the dark palm print, I could see my blurred image, but also my mother's face shimmering on a rooftop over an unknowable city, talking to the quarter moon. I wanted to hear what she was saying. I wanted to smell that burnt midnight again. I wanted to feel that wind. It was a secret wanting, like a song that I couldn't stop humming, or loving someone I could never have. No matter where I went, my compass pointed west. I would always know what time it was. In California.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of White Oleander, written by Janet Fitch and performed by Oprah Winfrey. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Text abridged by John Whitman. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. Recording engineer, George Lampros, Studio 300. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Data Sound. White Oleander is also available in hardcover from Little Brown & Company. This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.